Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, we look at some of what may be in store for the Oregon criminal justice system in 2019. The Oregon legislature is not currently in session, yet committees are at work preparing the legislative agenda for next session. In that regard, there was a joint meeting of the Oregon State House and Senate Judiciary Committees on September 26th. That meeting was an informational session in which they heard invited testimony on a half dozen different issue areas. They were following up on legislation from previous sessions, as well as looking at possible legislation for the 2019 session and beyond. On this half hour, we're going to hear about juvenile justice reform and behavioral health justice reinvestment. Let's start first with behavioral health. This is Steve Allen. He's a senior policy advisor for the Council of State Governments Justice Center.
For the record, my name is Steve Allen. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Council of State Governments Justice Center. I want to start out by saying my colleagues at the Justice Center are very jealous of me and the rest of our team that's here in Oregon because you folks have a gorgeous state. You'll see from a map that comes up how many counties that we've visited. I'm pleased to say that we have visited at least one or more counties and everyone who's sitting at the table in your districts, and we'd be pleased to provide you with who we visited with and when if you make that request of us. Secondarily, the quality of the people that we've been engaged with in all of our visits across the state are just incredible. The quality of the people, the thoughtfulness of the approach, the dedication to these challenges, and the heartfelt interest in changing the course for people who are involved in the criminal justice system with addictions and mental illness is really compelling to us. We have been greatly encouraged, and our enthusiasm is high because of the consistency of that dedication and encouragement by people in your districts wanting the state and the counties to take these issues on. We're being told this is the right project at the right time for the state of Oregon. We're also quite impressed with the quality of the thinking. We work in lots of states around the country. I think this is the 28th state that we've worked on in Justice Reinvestment Project. So we're familiar with a lot of different state approaches to criminal justice systems. And your staff, the people that are working your systems, are at an advanced level. They know the ABCs. The joy and pleasure for us is to be able to build on strengths that are already there in your system. So you have a good, solid foundation to work on. All of that being said, we also consistently have been asked to help shape policies that will help counties do what they can't do for themselves. And sometimes it's a matter of growing programs, scaling programs that are already productive and are accomplishing things. Thank you, Senator.
I apologize. I have other meetings.
Thank you, Senator, for your time.
In other cases, it's creating infrastructure that folks don't already have and can't easily build themselves. And so we welcome this opportunity and challenge to work with you and with your state. in moving this project forward for the 19 session. We are, I can't say early on in this project anymore. We are well along in this project, but we are far from having policy recommendations forward. We are looking forward to our first steering committee meeting in October, a second meeting in December, and then a meeting with recommendations in mid-January, just as the session is starting. I will not spend a lot of time on these slides, but wanted to introduce you first to us. For as I look around the table, I see a lot of familiar faces, but we want to make sure that all of the members of this joint committee are familiar with us at CSG and this project as a whole. So Council of State Governments, we've been around since the Great Depression, the Justice Center for over a decade. We work with states and counties on a wide range of issues. The Justice Center, as you'd expect, works with states and counties on criminal justice challenges. We are funded through the Bureau of Justice Assistance and with some additional funding from Pew Charitable Trust. So we're here at no direct cost to Oregon taxpayers, although for anyone familiar with projects like these, you understand that there's significant sweat equity in moving a project like this forward. Before going further to, I notice Director Allen's here and Director Mike Schmidt from CJC, who isn't able to be here today. I just want to acknowledge for both of those directors how supportive they have been through this project so far. They have made their staff available at every turn, been incredibly patient and helpful in their guidance in support of this project. And we would not be as far and as fast as we've been without their direct support. So thank you. We started out with phone calls and meetings starting in April and then held a May forum. In that May forum, we invited representatives to the LIPSICs. 32 of the 36 counties were in attendance, over 260 people in attendance. And as you'll see at the bottom, a wide range of stakeholders involved. We were sort of taking the temperature of the state. Is the state ready to move forward? And do we have the design of the project right, which is a county-based sort of bottom-up project? And we received overwhelming support. Earlier in the project, we had a number of themes that we picked up on. I will say that these themes are still present, although other themes have also emerged, and some themes stronger than others. But persistent access, as you've been hearing today, for treatment and crisis centers, housing, et cetera, especially in rural areas, treatment reimbursement rates. People are concerned about are folks able to sustain treatment resources in various parts of the state, provider workforce, recruitment and retention, slow adoption of some evidence-based practices, case coordination, collaboration are challenges in some places, especially barriers to information sharing, duplication of services. So in some cases, an assessment is done multiple times through the course of someone's trajectory unnecessarily, simply because information can't readily be shared, and a lack of system accountability. So what are Oregon's getting for their taxpayers' money? Are people's outcomes improving based on these assessments? And most frequently we find that folks just don't have the data to answer those questions at this point. We were officially invited to engage in this broader justice reinvestment project over the summer, and you'll see signatories from both chambers, both sides of the aisle, et cetera. So we feel strong support to move this project forward. We have some basic principles as we engage in justice reinvestment. Each state's unique, and as we get out in Oregon counties, every county, you've seen one county, you've seen one county, lots of differences, lots of different strengths among one from another. Data, we're data geeks, and we're happy to talk more about the data-driven process that we have, we are engaging in. We expect that this project can be cost neutral and improve public safety. Bipartisan interbranch commitments is extraordinarily helpful, especially as we enter the session. Policy and budgetary changes must result. Engagement of stakeholders, as you see, we've been hitting the pavement, and it needs to be sustainable. So in our view, anything that's worth pursuing ought to be worth pursuing and sustaining for the long haul. So what do we hope to accomplish? And this is based on stakeholder input at this point. what's missing is some fundamental behavioral health infrastructure at the community level, and those that are tailored to be successful for people in the criminal justice system, reducing the number of people who are entering jails with mental illness and addictions where that's where that can be prevented, create efficient case management, data sharing systems, and to improve system effectiveness and accountability. Missing from this list, Yamhill County that we just visited yesterday, and for some reason, missing one other, but we'll be driving down to Klamath and Jackson County this evening, so we'll, those counties will turn green as by the end of the week. You'll see the wide range of folks that we've reached out to, a lot in person, but also through emails, through phone calls, etc. So our list will be broadening. We want to capture as many perspectives as possible. The senator talked about this multi-system data mix that we are looking at. We're very excited by this. This process will include jail data from approximately 15 jails across the state. It will include representation from urban, rural, and frontier counties. We expect to have jail data that represents about 65%+ of the state's population, so a very robust group of jail data that we're very excited about. That jail data will be matched with community corrections data from probation, parole that we already have in hand, and then linked through integrated client services with Medicaid and Oregon State Hospital data with OHA support. At the end of it, then, we'll have the ability to look at this population of adults with addictions and mental illness who are frequently moving through across systems in a very detailed and in-depth way, and we hope to present that data in early December. And here's the timeline. As you can see, we've been busy since even before May and April, visiting lots of counties and other stakeholders here in Salem and Portland throughout the summer. In the fall, we'll get busy with our presentation development and have three presentations in mid-October, probably early December, and then mid-January with policy recommendations ahead of the 19th session.
That was Steve Allen, a senior advisor with the Council on State Government Justice Center, talking about the Behavioral Health Justice Reinvestment Project before a joint meeting of the Oregon State House and Senate Judiciary Committees on September 26th. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. The committees also looked at juvenile justice reform and got an update from their juvenile justice work group. First, let's hear from Nicola Nabel Juris, senior policy counsel with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth.
My name is Nicola Nabel Juris, and I'm the senior policy counsel at the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. And just to provide context, the campaign is a national nonprofit that works around the country with local coalition members and legislators on both sides of the aisle who are seeking to bring their youth sentencing laws into compliance with recent U.S. Supreme Court cases and just national best practices as to youth sentencing. I have the pleasure of reporting out for the Life Sentences Working Group. This particular sub-working group is exploring legislative options relating to youth who are under 18 at the time of their criminal offenses, but have been convicted in adult court and have received sentences that include life without the possibility of parole, life with the possibility of parole, or lengthy term of year sentences that, in many cases may be considered life equivalent sentences. And in the brief time that I have, I'd like to just share a little bit about what has happened nationally to inspire this group. The U.S. Supreme Court has had four recent decisions about sentencing youth who are under 18 in the adult criminal justice system. All four of these cases have been grounded in Eighth Amendment jurisprudence about what constitutes a cruel and unusual punishment for children under 18. And all four decisions have also been grounded in recent research about adolescent brain development over the course of the last few decades. This research, as the court cites in each case, has shown first that adolescents are different than their adult counterparts. As many parents and teachers would know, their brains are still developing up to and beyond the age of 18, which means that they're calculus of risks versus rewards are different than adults. They're much more impulsive. They respond to peer pressure differently. You know, their home environments they can't control. So that makes them different than adults. But secondarily, their brains are still developing, which means they're uniquely able to be rehabilitated. You know, no one is the same person who they were at 15 as they are at 25, 35, 45. And so the U.S. Supreme Court in 2005 decided the case of Roper v. Simmons, deciding that the death penalty was unconstitutional for children who were under 18 years of age, that it was cruel and unusual punishment for this population who committed their crimes under 18. In 2010, they decided the Graham versus Florida decision, restricting life without parole sentences, as stating that they were unconstitutional for youth under 18 who committed non-homicide offenses. It was just disproportionate if a victim wasn't killed in the offense. And the court stated that youth under 18 needed to have, quote, a meaningful opportunity for review, end quote. Just 2 years later, in 2012, in the Miller versus Alabama decision, the U.S. Supreme Court came back again and declared mandatory life without parole sentences unconstitutional for youth under 18, saying that judges really needed to have sentencing discretion with this population. And as you can imagine, they had a lot of discrepancy as to whether that applied retroactively or not. So the U.S. Supreme Court came back again just 2 years ago in 2016 to decide the case of Montgomery versus Louisiana, in which they clearly stated that the 2012 Miller decision did apply retroactively to all children across the country who were serving life without parole sentences, and clearly articulated that life without parole was unconstitutional for the vast majority of children under 18. Unless a child was found to be, quote, permanently incorrigible, they couldn't receive a life without parole sentence. So as you might expect, states have been litigating this issue in many, many ways. You know, in addition to saying whether these decisions applied retroactively, states have been grappling with the question of at what point in time is review necessary to, you know, be considered a meaningful chance at review. For those lengthy term of year sentences, at what point is such a sentence considered life equivalent? You know, what does it mean to be impermanently incorrigible? How does a judge determine that, you know, when someone is 14, 15, 16, 17? And so a number of states around the country have resolved these questions through legislation. You have a handout that's hopefully been provided showing how in 2012, only five states banned life without parole sentences for youth under 18. And today, that number has quadrupled, with 20 states having passed legislation to ban life without parole sentences for youth under 18, and an additional five states that no longer use it. The current leaders around the country in this reform effort have been West Virginia, Arkansas, and Nevada. And I often say when you have California and Massachusetts and the Dakotas and Arkansas on the same map, it's really not a partisan policy or a geographic policy, but really is where the country has been headed based on the U.S. Supreme Court decisions and where adolescent development research is demonstrating. So just in closing, to share what possible policy proposals have been discussed by the working group. The ideas have included banning life without parole sentences for youth who are under 18 in Oregon, determining what youth-related factors judges should consider when they're sentencing a child, just to, you know, ground their sentencing decision in what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. Removing the requirement of a conversion hearing for youth who are under 18 at the time of their offense. That's the hearing for individuals who have received life with the possibility of parole, but while they're going through the stages of eligibility, determining whether they're able to be rehabilitated. Additional ideas have included giving parole eligibility to all youth after a certain time frame, to say that they get a chance at review, not a guarantee of release, but a chance of review. And then establishing youth-related factors for the parole board to consider at the time of a parole hearing, because they're often seeing individuals who are in, you know, their 30s, 40s, 50s, but were really a teenager at the time of their offense. So setting that population apart in parole review. I know that was a lot of information in a very short amount of time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, or I know there's some materials I've shared with Whitney that might go a little bit more in depth to those Supreme Court cases or what other states have done, but I'm happy to, you know, even answer questions after today if I can be of assistance in that way.
That was Nicola Nabel-Juris, Senior Policy Counsel with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, testifying about juvenile justice reform at that joint committee hearing. Now let's hear Bobin Singh, Executive Director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
My name is Bobin Singh. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center and a member of the Juvenile Justice Workgroups. I'll be providing a brief update on the work subgroup of the work of the sub-work group that has been reviewing the policy of automatically waiving youth 15, 16, and 17-year-olds into the adult court system. Specifically, our discussions over the past few months have focused on whether or not the policy of automatically prosecuting youth as adults for certain crimes is consistent with our modern understanding of brain science and research, and generally, whether or not the policy of prosecuting youth as adults under Measure 11 is fair and equitable. In 1994, as you may recall, Oregon voters approved ballot Measure 11, a mandatory minimum sentencing scheme for person or violent crimes. The measure passed at a time of increased concern across the country about youth violence. It became law the following year, allowing children as young as 15 to be charged, convicted, and sentenced as adults for certain acts, meaning that those convicted face the same penalties as over 18-year-olds despite their young age. In the two decades that Measure 11 has been in force, while there have been some updates and modifications, the fundamentals are generally unchanged. Anyone convicted must serve a sentence of a duration set out by law, not assessed by a judge with the discretion to consider mitigating circumstances. There's no possibility of parole, so people cannot reduce their sentences through good behavior or efforts to rehabilitate themselves. Earlier this year, the Oregon Council on Civil Rights, in collaboration with my organization, published a report that took an in-depth look at the impact of Measure 11 on Oregon's young people and whether the law is out of step with legal and scientific developments of recent years. And this report has served as a framework for the discussion of the work group. We presented the findings of this report at an informational hearing earlier this year, at which time Senators Przanski and Dembro initiated the Juvenile Justice Work Group. In our work group meetings, we have reviewed Measure 11, its impact on youth from a variety of perspectives for a thorough review. And these perspectives include, first, brain science. While research shows that young people's brains aren't fully developed until their mid to late 20s, Measure 11 allows children to be sentenced as though they had the culpability of adults. We have reviewed and discussed how scientific understanding and development has grown and how the law should respond. Second, legal developments, which Nicola spoke about a little bit. A series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions has overhauled youth sentencing laws in light of growing understanding of brain development in young people. In light of the Supreme Court's decisions, more than half the states have made changes to their sentencing laws for young people convicted of homicide to allow the possibility of parole. Yet Oregon is lagging behind with no legal reforms yet to end the sentencing of children to life without parole or extremely lengthy sentences found under Measure 11. The former Chief Justice of Oregon Supreme Court, Justice Ballmer, in a recent concurring opinion, called on the Oregon legislature to revisit Measure 11 in light of its failure to take into account circumstances and mitigating qualities of youth and its removal of discretion from judges to sentence individuals appropriately. Third perspective is data analysis. Analysis of data tracked since Measure 11 began in 1995 through 2012, which is the data set that we had available to us, revealed the following information. Nearly 4,000 Oregon youth were charged with Measure 11 offenses from 1995 to 2012, an average of 221 cases per year. 64% of the youth, nearly two-thirds, brought into the adult court through Measure 11 did not end up with a Measure 11 conviction. Measure 11 has had a disproportionate impact on youth of color. Data shows racial disparities between black and white youth being indicted for Measure 11 between 1995 and 2012 were that black youth were around 8.6 times more likely to be indicted on a Measure 11 charge than would be expected based on their relative share of the general population. In 2012, black youth were 26.1 times more likely to be indicted for a Measure 11 offense than white youth. The work group continues to review all this information and discuss whether or not automatic waiver of youth under Measure 11 is actually a sound policy. We're currently discussing in more detail what it means to return Oregon to a judicial waiver system. And under this system, a youth starts out initially in the juvenile justice in the juvenile system, and it then requires a process that mandates a prosecutor to make a case before a judge as to why a youth should be prosecuted as an adult, and also allows the defense to present mitigating evidence as to why the youth should remain in the juvenile system. Much of our discussion now has been around on what this waiver process would look like, what would be the standard for the waiver to be successful, and what information voices should be included in that waiver hearing. I remain optimistic that the work group will develop a concept for the upcoming session that will be grounded in the best practices, evidence, and the latest development in brain science. And I also remain optimistic that whatever a concept emerges, that it will ensure first and foremost that youth are treated as a youth and are afforded all the protections and supports necessary to create the greatest opportunity for rehabilitation and reform.
That was Bobin Singh, Executive Director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. He testified before a joint meeting of the Oregon State Legislature's Judiciary Committees on September 26th, updating them on the progress of the Juvenile Justice Workgroup. The Oregon State Legislature convenes its 2019 regular session on January 22nd. That regular session is scheduled to run through June 30th of 2019. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you've been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline at the website kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give that page a like and share it with friends. A heartfelt thank you to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Fataklis. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. Join us next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard.